You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A recent report by the Centers for Disease Control says the use and abuse of painkillers, also known as opioids, has reached epidemic proportions. The number of overdose deaths from drugs like OxyContin, Vicodin, Percocet, and fentanyl is higher than it is for heroin and cocaine combined. Although at one time these types of drugs were only reserved for terminally ill cancer patients because of the dangers of addiction, last year alone, 254 million prescriptions for opioids were filled in the United States. In her latest article for Fortune magazine called OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine, Catherine Eban looks at the development of the number one pain-killing drug in the United States and the company behind its creation, and I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show today. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
250 million prescriptions filled in 1 year. What's the financial impact of that on the healthcare industry?
It is enormous. I mean, the costs of it are over $70 billion to private health insurers every year. Incredible consequences of that, the cost of the medicine itself. This is like a huge mega industry within an industry.
Well, millions of Americans suffer from chronic pain, don't they?
Well, that is certainly the selling point of Purdue Pharma and other painkiller companies, that there is an epidemic of untreated pain. But you've got to ask yourself, you know, how much pain are we in?
Well, who's prescribing this? Can any doctor do it?
You have to be registered with the DEA, and, you know, it's tightly monitored in the sense that it's a triplicate prescription, so you're not just sort of dashing off an endless refill prescription. But that said, really this sort of business strategy of Purdue Pharma and other companies like this is to expand the market so that you basically wind up writing prescriptions for people who have chronic pain, not just terminal cancer pain.
And these opioids are obviously getting into the hands of people who don't need them. Do we know how many people are dying every year as a result of overdosing?
Yeah, it's really astonishing. The estimates are around 15,000 Americans a year are dying of overdoses from these drugs.
And how does that compare to heroin?
Oh, that's greatly increased from heroin. I mean, and I've had people estimate that they think that the 15,000 number is a dramatic undercount.
Mm-hmm.
If you find somebody with a pill bottle next to them who's died, then obviously, you know, you wind up doing an autopsy, but there's a lot of deaths that don't get recorded in that number.
And what we hear about mostly are abuse of methamphetamines. Why aren't we hearing more about abuse of this?
Well, I think part of the complication is that these are legal drugs and these are legitimate, quote unquote, prescriptions. So a lot of the time, you know, this is just a doctor's decision with a patient on how to treat something.
But are all these people getting them through legitimate prescriptions? Is there a street traffic in these drugs?
There's a huge street traffic in it. I mean, you know, OxyContin is hawked on the street corners of most major cities and in back lanes in West Virginia and Kentucky, for sure. I guess the thing is that most of those drugs originally with a legitimate doctor's prescription.
How much would I have to pay for them? I'm just asking you as an interviewer.
Right. It's a little bit now under $1 a milligram. So traditionally, if you were going to get an 80 milligram OxyContin tablet on the street, nicknamed hillbilly heroin, you might have paid a little under $80 for a pill like that.
I'm assuming that that people start taking this because they do have acute pain, and then at a certain point they just learn to like it?
Well, that's really the question. Either they learn to like it or they simply can't get off of it because this drug is highly addictive. I mean, it's basically heroin. It's heroin made in a lab.
Well, it's made from opium.
Right.
So it is like heroin, and there are a lot of other opiate drugs out there,
right,
that we have been very concerned about. Most of them are illegal, aren't they? Or they're really tightly prescribed. Why isn't that the case with something like OxyContin?
Well, they're not all that. They're tightly monitored once they're prescribed, but they're widely, widely prescribed.
I mean, like morphine. You can't get morphine, can you?
Well, you can if your doctor prescribes it. Absolutely. And that's really been the big sea change here is that more and more doctors are prescribing opioids for things like backache.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So you take it for backache, which is something that can come and go. And then the backache goes away. You're not sure whether it went away because you took the painkiller or because it just went away. But meanwhile, now you can't live without the drug.
Right. And that's what we're documenting in the Fortune
and
article.
And how long does it take to become addicted? Do we know?
You can get addicted with just one prescription of it. You know, there's a lack of education on the part of doctors often about how you prescribe, how long you prescribe for. I mean, let's say you go in for a dental surgery, and your doctor may write you a prescription for a month's worth of Vicodin or OxyContin. You may have only needed 3 days of it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you continue to take it, or maybe your kid takes it from the medicine cabinet.
And you're actually told to take a complete prescription usually, not just a couple of pills. There is usually a concern that if you just take a couple of pills, you may be getting a little better, but then you haven't completely cured the problem.
Right. And the question is, are you really getting cured from opioids?
Now, do we have any sense of the breakdown of demographics, whether there are more women or men or younger people or older people who are taking these drugs?
White men in their 30s and 40s are taking these drugs big time.
And you mentioned certain parts of the country.
Right. I mean, there has been an epidemic of abuse really noted in the middle of the country and noted in, you know, West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Appalachia. I mean, that's been a sort of famously the epidemic. Also in Florida, where now 8 people a day die of opioid overdoses.
Is in Florida where Rush Limbaugh got his OxyContin. What happens when someone like Rush Limbaugh is caught buying OxyContin illegally? Does that have much of an effect on the way the public views drugs like these?
Well, unfortunately, in part it becomes a learning experience for other people who hear about the drug and they're like, oh, maybe I'll try that too. So I know that authorities certainly have that concern that with every publicized case of opioid abuse, more people learn about it. More people learn about the possibility of, say, with the old formulation of OxyContin, crushing it and snorting it, or crushing it, adding water, and injecting it.
In recent years, addiction to painkillers has made national headlines in large part because of a number of celebrities who died as a result of overdosing or crimes committed by addicts trying to get their hands on the drug. Mm-hmm. Some targeting pharmacies. Are some pharmacies reluctant to carry these drugs?
They are absolutely reluctant to carry these drugs. And so, you know, some people say that the reformulation of OxyContin, which makes it harder to abuse, might end up legitimizing the drug more and result in more addiction and more prevalence of use.
So it's been reformulated in response to concerns about addiction?
Yes, it has been.
Has it eliminated its addictive qualities?
I would not say eliminated, because if you go on these addiction chat sites, they are alive with discussion about how to break down this drug to crush it in order to get all of the hit of the drug at once.
Now, if a doctor, there are obviously some doctors who are abusing their power to prescribe these. Have any of them been punished?
There have been. There have been a number of very high-profile prosecutions of doctors who, the allegation is, were basically running pill mills, you know, who were writing prescriptions for cash, who were dispensing these drugs willy-nilly in these Florida pain clinics, which have just been cracked down on. You know, so there's a huge question of whether doctors are abusing their prescription power.
My guest is Catherine Eben, who is a contributor to Fortune magazine, and her article in that magazine is called OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine. It's in this month's issue. And you focused on OxyContin. There are a number of drugs that are like this. Why this one in particular?
Well, for a couple of reasons. People really blame Purdue Pharma for the epidemic that we now find ourselves hit with. The reason is they were the first company to actively promote opioids.
Wasn't when they first started producing them, didn't they sell them as addiction proof?
They did. And in fact, they were prosecuted by the government for making unscientific claims about their drugs.
Well, how can you sell an opioid that is addiction proof. Opium is always addictive, isn't it?
That is the very point. That's right. I mean, that everybody, I mean, from, you know, for thousands of years, people have been searching for a way to actually get the benefits of opium and not suffer the consequences of abuse. And so Purdue Pharma entered the market presenting the drug as a sort of magic bullet of being addiction-proof because it had a time-release mechanism built into it.
Well, but this was in the early 1990s.
Yes.
And prescriptions were at relatively low levels, weren't they?
Right, and they knew that. So the thing is that they went about trying to expand the market for opioids. I mean, if you have, if your business model is dying cancer patients, well, you know, your customers die pretty quickly. But if you could expand the market and have customers who are arthritis sufferers, back pain sufferers, and get them to take your product, then they can take it, you know, for months and months, if not years.
If somebody is dying in a hospital, has terrible pain, there's less concern over whether they're going to become addicted or not. The most important thing is relieving the pain and making their dying days as comfortable as possible.
Right.
But how do we expand that to arthritis and back pain and other things that are, you know, are not terminal?
Well, Purdue Pharma made the claim that because the time-release mechanism would extend the life of the drug for, you know, 12 hours, it would also prevent addicts from getting that jolt up front so they wouldn't want it. And, of course, it took about a nanosecond for addicts to figure out they could crush the drug and snort it and get the hit of the drug all at once up front.
Does Purdue Pharma, which is a family company owned by three brothers, does it produce any other pharmaceuticals of note?
Well, it does. I mean, and it has been in the painkiller business. It produces MS-Contin, which is a time-released morphine drug. It also produces laxatives, and it did previously produce earwax removers, but they're known for their OxyContin, and it makes up about 95% of their revenue.
And in 2007, they pleaded guilty for misbranding the drug, paid $635 million in penalties. And they're on probation of sorts, aren't they?
Yes.
So why does this continue?
That's an excellent question. You know, a lot of people would say, well, they have so much money in this game. They have so much political power. They have so much clout. And they've made the argument that there is this epidemic of untreated pain in America, which, you know, has been somewhat persuasive.
My guest is Catherine Eben, who is a contributor to Fortune magazine. Her article, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine, is in the current issue of the magazine. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Catherine Eben. Her article, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine, is in the current issue of Fortune magazine, where she is a contributor. Have you gotten any feedback? Right now, there is so much talk about deregulating and letting the market take care of itself. Are some Fortune readers outraged that you wrote this article?
Well, it's really interesting because so many of the comments that we got were from the marijuana lobby that said, well, you know, this stuff is so bad for everybody and, you know, nobody's committing quadruple homicides in order to get marijuana. Why don't we just legalize that?
We have a number of listeners who've been writing in and calling. A listener on Twitter asks, isn't there still a lack of pain meds for many people here in the United States and worldwide?
I don't think so. I don't get the sense from my reporting that there is undertreated pain. But I do think that there are now wary doctors who are concerned about writing these scripts given the consequences.
Well, Kate in Brooklyn writes, the ease of getting opioids doesn't match my experience at all. My father in New Orleans had terminal cancer, and every time we try to get him adequate painkillers to assuage his pain, we face many obstacles. Even the nurse visiting him on a regular basis was frustrated by how hard it was to get the right dosage. He suffered more than he had to because the doctors were so reluctant to up his prescription, even though he had stage 4 lung cancer.
Well, that's really extraordinary and very sad. I'm sorry to hear that because, I mean, that is exactly the kind of patient that these drugs were, you know, originally marketed for. I mean, they are supposed to be helping that very kind of patient.
We have a call, of Andrew from Maimonides Hospital. Hi, Andrew.
Hi. Thank you very much for covering this story, and thank you, Catherine, as well, for your reporting on this. My name is Andrew Klodny. I treat people who are addicted to pain pills. About two-thirds of the people I treat became addicted through what we would call non-medical use, and about a third became addicted through treatment for chronic pain.
Wait, so the majority are people who just took these drugs because they wanted because they were drug abusers?
I would say about two-thirds of my patients are in their 20s and 30s. They're young adults. This is the drug that's extremely available because it's so easily prescribed by many physicians, and this is what's used recreationally. Unfortunately, many of the young people who are using these drugs recreationally don't realize what Catherine said earlier, which is that these drugs are almost identical to heroin. So many of them think that they're using a soft drug when, in fact, they're using a drug that's very much like heroin.
Well, heroin is really hard to kick, isn't it? The various treatments, methadone is controversial. The alternative, I guess, going cold turkey can be horrifying. How do you get off of one of these drugs?
You're absolutely right. Opioid addiction is extremely difficult to treat. Methadone is one treatment option, which is controversial. Another treatment option is a medication called buprenorphine, which works quite well while people are taking it. But actually, many people don't do well when they come off of that medication. So for people who become addicted, it is a lifelong chronic problem that many will struggle with. What's especially concerning, though, is that many of the doctors who are accidentally getting their patients addicted are really well-meaning. It's, you know, there's a lot of attention paid to doctors that are really operating pill mills. But probably a bigger problem is doctors who are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to help patients, and they've been very grossly misinformed about the risks of the medication. So they actually believe that treating back pain with opioids is a good idea. They think that's compassionate care, and they're getting many of their patients addicted.
A listener writes in, are you familiar with Vivitrol, the only FDA-approved therapy to treat opioid dependence? Is it effective?
It is. That's another good treatment. It is not the only FDA-approved medication for opioid addiction. Both buprenorphine and methadone are FDA-approved, but that is another treatment option that is evidence-based and does help many people.
Now, you're in the medical community, and I'll ask you and Catherine this. How did the medical community react to the federal criminal counts against Purdue? Did that slow down prescriptions for a while?
I don't really think it did. And actually, it's unfortunate, but many physicians get much of their education from the pharmaceutical companies on a variety of medications. And with regard to opioids, many physicians are continuing to be taught that they shouldn't worry about getting patients addicted and that these medications have low risks and high benefits for patients, when many of the leading pain specialists in the country, those who do not work as spokesmen for the opioid manufacturers, are trying to get a message out that treating chronic pain with opioids is harming more people than it's helping.
Dr. Klodny, thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
Do you want to add to that?
Yeah. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about this from a business perspective is that this is a company that pleaded guilty to misbranding this drug. Their top three executives took misdemeanor pleas, left the company, and their sales of this drug did not drop 1 year. I mean, it's really amazing.
They were initially very reluctant to speak with you and then pretty much opened their doors. Why do you think that is?
Well, I would say they opened their doors and monitored me closely once I got inside the building. But, you know, I made the case to them, which I think is true, that every company has a story to tell, and they are doing some positive things. And I am obligated as a journalist to try to tell their side of the story, which becomes a lot harder to do if they don't talk to me.
So you were brought into their offices in Stamford, Connecticut.
Right.
What was the first thing you asked them?
Well, I asked them to tell me what they are doing now in order to protect us from these opioids. And that is one of the ironies here, is that the company has tried to rebrand itself as the sheriff of the drug supply to protect us from the very opioids it has unleashed on us.
So this is kind of like some company that sells alcoholic beverages telling you that drinking to excess is bad.
Well, exactly, but the...
And smoking, tobacco companies telling us that we shouldn't smoke even though they're selling the tobacco.
Yes, but what's even weirder here is that these drugs are supposed to be part of the solution, so doctors prescribe it legally. It's a complicated picture.
You learned of a program called RX Patrol, which the company launched to fight drug abuse. What is it, and how is that created?
So RX Patrol, which is launched by Purdue Pharma, as you said, is... a website that links up all law enforcement with notices about crimes at pharmacies. So, for example, I write about this quadruple homicide that occurred here in Long Island in the summer. A guy seeking drugs went into a pharmacy and just shot and killed four people in cold blood and left with 11,000 pills of hydrocodone. Purdue Pharma, which does not make hydrocodone, offered a reward through the Crime Stoppers program for his apprehension.
They're actually training police officers on how to recognize abuse of pharmaceuticals.
They are. And, I mean, that's a very interesting
thing. These are all good things, aren't they?
They are all good things, but it's definitely a piece of branding to put yourself on the side of law enforcement. It's also a way possibly to forestall more regulation of your product if you say, look, we're part of the solution.
John, one of our listeners, left this comment on our show page. He said he used prescribed OxyContin, or as named Percocet, for a broken leg. In under a week, he experienced diminishing results with high agitation, addiction, he believed, and was able to stop use at that point, but he had very strong and very fast negative effects.
Right.
That's after a week.
That is the physical dependence part of this drug. And really one of the questions here is how much of Purdue's business model is based on continuing use because of dependence.
So they created these programs after the criminal charges were made against them?
They started creating these programs once they got in some seriously hot water with the government. And once it was clear that there was an epidemic that was off the charts and abuse of this drug taking place.
My guest is Catherine Eban. Her article, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine, is being published in Fortune magazine, where she is a contributor. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Are the other companies that produce similar drugs equally culpable in your eyes?
Well, I do think that Purdue Pharma bears this distinction that they were the first people who marketed these opioids for wide public use.
Now, we are all familiar with the heavy advertising, particularly on television for pharmaceuticals, usually during 60 Minutes and news broadcasts. Didn't one of the founding brothers of Purdue contribute to the creation of that marketing model?
Absolutely. Arthur Sackler, who basically believed that you could sell pharmaceuticals by buying doctors. So what you would do is, you know, junkets, expensive trips, speakers, bureaus, all the things in the playbook that we're familiar with today to promote pharmaceuticals.
And you're saying that initially this was really just for cancer patients, and then they convinced doctors that it might be applicable to any kind of pain?
Well, their promotion was several-fold, but one was to promote the idea that we had an epidemic of untreated pain in America, in order to make doctors feel more comfortable prescribing it, but also convincing doctors that this was abuse resistant, so that you wouldn't have, if somebody was coming and asking for a prescription, they weren't a drug user.
Now, here's the other side. A listener left this comment. I suffer from chronic pain, a bad disc in my lower back. I take prescribed OxyContin as needed, one tablet, not more than once a day or every other day. It has been a miracle drug for me, made the difference between being able to function or not, to be happy or not, to be able to think clearly.
There are absolutely those patients out there, and the executives at Purdue Pharma have said to me they feel proud of what they do. That's why they go to work. So there absolutely are those stories.
Now, what are the recent figures in revenue for OxyContin?
Well, in the last calendar year, they sold about $3.2 billion worth of OxyContin, and that makes up about 95% of their revenue.
Now, how does we mentioned the new formulation, which was first made available August 2010.
Right.
What kind of marketing campaign did they use?
Very little, and because, you know, their whole problem was marketing. I mean, that's why they had to plead guilty. So they are very specific about saying they're making no claims about this new tamper-resistant formula.
They maintain that they've been working on a reformulation before the criminal case. Is there a way to determine if that's true?
They were working on a tamper-resistant formulation. That is true. It's hard to say exactly when that effort got underway, but I mean, they were in a lot of trouble with the government for about 5 years before they made a settlement.
Now, is this something that is mostly an American problem?
No, it is not. I mean, you see, wherever there has been a lot of marketing of these opioids, you see a serious epidemic of abuse and addiction. So England, Australia, you've seen that as well.
Haven't some drug companies been accused of producing a lot more than the official demand in the United States would warrant, and then just selling them in large quantities in Mexico and other places like that, with the understanding, although they deny that, that they would wind up back in the United States?
Yeah, which is the phenomenon of diversion. And in fact, Purdue Pharma stopped selling in Mexico because of allegations that that is what was happening. A lot of Mexican OxyContin was getting diverted and winding up in the United States on the streets.
Do you think that doctors need to receive narcotics training? I wonder if they're even taught this in medical school.
That is really something that people are talking about as part of the solution. So, you know, if you're a dentist and you went to medical school 30 years ago and you really don't know much about these opioids, how do you prescribe them responsibly?
The DEA actually controls how much of these drugs can be brought to market. After the criminal case involving OxyContin, did the manufacturing numbers go down?
No, they went up. And that has been the subject of a lot of inquiry and complaint, which is that the quotas that the DEA allows have ticked ever upward. And Purdue Pharma actually owns a subsidiary that brings in the raw materials for these drugs. So, you know, there's a whole corporate engine around a sort of pipeline of the raw material.
A listener suggests that the companies understand that they're going to be fined, but they see that just as part of the cost of doing business.
Yeah. Most pharmaceutical companies, or many of them, are actually convicted felons. I mean, they have pleaded guilty to felonies of misbranding and off-label promotion of drugs, and it is the cost of doing business. You know, the money that they pay off in fines generally doesn't amount to what they've made from doing it.
But I always thought you went into the pharmaceutical business because you wanted to help people.
Yes.
Maybe I should end it on that laugh. Catherine Eben's article, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma's Painful Medicine, is in the current issue of Fortune magazine, where she is a contributor. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.